IELTS Listening Practice Tests by IELTS Success Group. Copyright 2021. This material may not be copied. IELTS Listening Practice Test 2.
Hi, Professor Johnson. Have you got a minute?
Oh, well, I have a class in about 5 minutes. Is it a quick question, or would you like to schedule an appointment during my office hour on Friday?
Oh, well, I'm afraid I can't come on Friday because I work in the library part-time. Anyway, hopefully it won't take too long.
Okay, what's up?
Well, you've probably noticed that I'm usually late for your 9 o'clock class.
Yes, of course I have. And to be honest, I'm glad you dropped in to talk about that.
The thing is, you know, I'm a mature student, and I'm a single parent, too. I have a little girl. She's 4. I have to drop her off at the daycare center before class. Well, the daycare center only opens at 9, so that's why I'm always late, because I have to go there first.
Well, have you talked to the people who run the daycare center? Would it be possible to drop your little girl off a little bit early? I mean, one of their members of staff could be available before 9.
No, I'm afraid not. I already asked them that, and the person in charge told me that because of their license, they can't open before 9 o'clock. It's something to do with the regulations of running a daycare center, and it just can't be changed.
Oh, I see. That's too bad. It must be inconvenient for you, but you know it's also causing inconvenience, in a way, to the other students in the 9 o'clock class.
I'm not really with you.
Well, what I'm getting is your persistent tardiness. It's become a little disruptive. I mean, I'm sure you've noticed that we usually start the class off with their questions and a refresher session from the previous class. So you miss all of that information. And then, of course, you have to get another one of the students to repeat all the information to you. And that's where the inconvenience comes in for them, in a way.
Well, what do you think I can do? I mean, I'm sorry, but it's just not going to be possible for me to be there on time.
Okay, look, there's a student in the same course, but that class meets at 2 o'clock. She can't come then because she has a part-time job, so if it's okay with you, maybe the two of you could change places. She could come to the 9 o'clock and you could take her place in the 2 o'clock session.
Oh, yes, that would be great. It would really solve my problem.
Okay, well, leave it with me. I'll talk to the other student and see if she'll agree to joining the 9 o'clock group, and then I'll send you an email to let you know. Is that okay?
That's great. Thanks a lot, Professor Johnson. I really appreciate it. See you later.
That is the end of Section 1. Section 2.
The tradition of music in the Western world, in other words, music as we know it today, originated in the genre of chanting. Prior to the 13th century, chant was the dominant mode of music. Notably, chanting was a monophonic form of music. Now, monophonic. Let's have a look at that word. Mono is from a Greek word. It means one thing, alone, or by itself. Phonic is also Greek in origin, and it means sound. So, monophonic music consists of only one sound or voice that is combined in various notes in a series. Polyphonic music appeared in the 15th century during the Renaissance period. In contrast to monophonic music, polyphonic music consists of more than one voice or instrument, and it combines the notes from the different sources together simultaneously. As polyphony developed, musical traditions began to change, and this meant that music began to rely on a greater range of voices. And really, this was a big range. From the very high to the very low. This kind of polyphonic musical influence is also present in the national anthems that emerged in various countries during this era. Next, let's have a look at the 16th century. particularly here, especially during the end of the 16th century, there was an attempt to return to the tradition of Greek drama. This had a particular influence on the opera. As a result, the opera expanded to include oratorios, which are sung musical extended compositions on a particular subject. This phenomenon was especially pronounced in the Italian opera, and so the opera, in turn, dominated the musical style of the early 17th century. The 17th century also witnessed the proliferation of musical instruments. Musical compositions and arrangements for keyboard instruments, such as the piano and organ, thrived during this period. Music for the orchestra, arrangements like sinfonias and concertos, also began to take off during this time. Now, next, let's have a look at the 18th century. The 18th century was marked by the development of Baroque music. Stringed instruments, particularly the violin, were predominant throughout this epoch. Since many of the German-born composers studied abroad, Baroque music was regarded to possess an international style. Other forms of classical music, especially the symphony, also developed during this century. Okay, so, 18th century music, many people believe this anyway, was dominated by two German-born geniuses, Bach and Handel. These two composers wrote music in almost every genre, including opera and oratorio music. Handel, of course, studied in both Italy and England, bearing out the point I made earlier about the international flavor of the musical compositions of this century. Bach, while similar in many ways to Handel, is perhaps best known for his liturgical, and by this I mean religious, music. Some music history scholars point out that Bach's work is significant historically too, since it shows the pervasive impact of the Reformation on the musical style of this century. Finally, then, no lecture on musical genre would be complete without a discussion of Beethoven. Beethoven really was a remarkable and versatile musician. He contributed to almost every style of music during this era, including piano, strings, and symphonies, and he also expanded the form of the symphony to include greater orchestration. Beethoven is often seen as the crucial link between the classical and romantic periods. He added deeper texture. By this I mean the depth and breadth of different kinds of musical sound, as well as aesthetics. And here, by aesthetics, we're talking about the beauty of the music itself. In other words, the sheer pleasure or enjoyment that a person can receive from listening to a truly beautifully composed piece of music. For these reasons, the music of Beethoven is commonly regarded as establishing the end of the classical period.
That is the end of Section 2. Section 3.
In today's class, we're going to talk about a worrying sociological problem, that of teenage smoking. Although the trends show that smoking by adults has been declining steadily over the past few decades, the percentage of teenagers who smoke only started to drop in the late 1990s. In fact, the current statistics on this are really quite alarming, because at present the rate of teenagers who smoke is nearly 50% greater than the rate for adult smokers. So my first question is this: what reasons can you give for these trends?
Well, could it be that teenagers are more prone to pressure from their friends? You know, peer pressure. And so, of course, they want to fit in with their social group, and smoking is one way to do that.
Yes, good answer. Peer pressure is really one of the biggest reasons why teens smoke. But, you know, peer pressure has always existed from time immemorial. Can you think of any other reasons? Reasons that are specifically connected with the current social and cultural phenomena?
Oh, yeah, I see what you're getting at. You know, with the increase in the use of things like the internet, and with a lot of parents working long hours, maybe kids feel a bit sort of alienated. Is that the right word? I mean, like, if the kid is by himself a lot, maybe he's just going to feel alone and not connected to anybody else but his friends. And then, of course, he's more susceptible to fall into the trap of smoking because of peer pressure.
Yes, exactly. You hit the nail on the head. In fact, recent research shows that the rise in teenage smoking in the 1990s primarily took place in the youth from more affluent families. You know, parents are working and earning good incomes. So, of course, children were not from disadvantaged homes, as some sociologists would like us to believe, quite the opposite. The most striking and precipitous rise was in teenagers from the most financially advantageous backgrounds. And we know that because of various lawsuits against the major tobacco companies. The price of cigarettes actually declined sharply in the 1990s, which of course added fuel to the fire that was already burning in this area socially. What I mean is, paradoxically, these teenagers from well-off families and could have afforded to pay the higher prices, yet contrary to these market forces, the price of tobacco products was reduced during this time. Okay, so from this we can surmise that the price doesn't really appear to be a factor in smoking by teens. Probably this is because teenagers often view themselves as experimental smokers. Now that's an interesting term, experimental smokers. What do you think it means or implies?
Well, it means they see their own smoking behavior as an experiment, obviously. So what that implies, I suppose, is, well, these kids think they're just trying it out, so they aren't necessarily actually going to do it, I mean, smoke for their lifetime. They maybe just view it as something they can try and then stop doing it later.
Yes, I couldn't have said it better myself. Okay, so the next logical question is, do you think that most of these teenagers, these experimental smokers, will eventually manage to stop smoking?
Personally, I think that's highly unlikely. I mean, I've heard that quitting smoking is an extremely difficult thing to do. I've heard it can be even tougher than beating drug addiction, because the nicotine in cigarettes is very highly addictive itself.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And again, the statistics bear this out. A recent study on high school students showed that 56% of all the students who smoked predicted that they would not still be smokers after 5 years of graduation. But when the data was gathered for 5 years later, only 31% of them had actually quit smoking.
That is the end of Section 3. Section 4.
Okay, everybody, I think we should probably get started. In the lecture for today, we're going to look at a hotly debated and contentious topic, genetic engineering. So first of all, we'll go into a little bit of the background information about this topic, and then we'll move on to consider the nuts and bolts, and by that I mean the basis of the genetic aspects of genetic engineering. And finally, we'll have a look at why this topic has become such a thorny issue recently. Okay, genetic engineering. Now, as biology students, you know that this term refers to the process of reprogramming the genetic materials that dictate how a plant or animal behaves. And it's probably no surprise to you that scientists have been conducting genetic engineering on plants for quite a few years now. Things like cereals and fruits, for example. Now, this has been done to produce better fruit, to grow fruit or even vegetables for that matter, outside of their normal season, and to make other plants, especially cereal crops, more resistant to damage from insects and disease. So, of course, the next question is, well, all may be aware of the basic idea behind genetic engineering, but what I'm exactly I'm referring to is, how is genetic engineering carried out on a genetic or biological level, specifically and precisely? That's the question we'll look at. Well, as we all know, the genetic characteristics of any organism are present in its DNA. DNA. I don't need to write that on the board, do I? Okay. So DNA is the genetic material found in each and every living cell. These form a genetic code and are formed from long molecules like chains. And these DNA chains consist of four separate components called nucleotides. Okay, that's a bit of a difficult term. I better put that one on the board. Nucleotides. It's the order of these nucleotides on the DNA chain that determines the reproductive information for the cells. In other words, the specific genetic information along any point of this DNA chain will determine a particular genetic trait. By way of example, in the case of human beings, a particular portion of your DNA might show your doctor if you are susceptible to a disease like cancer or Alzheimer's disease. So then, in order to carry out what's known as genetic engineering, gene splicing needs to be done at first. Gene splicing. This describes a process whereby a small part of the DNA chain for one characteristic of one organism is cut out of the DNA chain for that organism and inserted into the DNA chain of another organism from another species. This has produced results like this super tomato. Now, the super tomato was genetically engineered by inserting some DNA from cold water fish. The particular gene resistance to cold temperatures was isolated on the DNA chain of the fish and was removed. This cold-resistant gene was reinserted into an ordinary tomato plant, and lo and behold, we now got tomato plants that can grow, or dare I say, thrive in cold weather conditions. Another experiment that was even more notorious, that of the super tomato, was the factor 9. Factor 9 is a genetic agent that is responsible for the clotting of blood. So if some people have a birth defect and are born without factor 9 in their DNA chain, it would be really easy for them to bleed to death in the event of an accident.
That is the end of section 4. That is the end of IELTS Listening Practice Test 2.